This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Lynn Mark. And today on The Breakfast Grill, I have with me Dr. Parag Khanna, Managing Partner of Future Map, a data and scenario-based strategic advisory firm, former senior fellow at the Lee Kuan Yew School and author of the book, The Future is Asian. Thank you for joining us, Parag.
My pleasure, Lynn. Great to be with you.
So first of all, let's set the premise. How do you define Asia as you address in your book?
It's a great question, and it's funny that you phrase it in that way, sort of how do I define Asia? Because, of course, today when you pick up different books that are about Asia, they tend to be mostly about China. You know, and you can publish a book today with the word Asia in the title, and 99% of the content is about China, and people may not even notice that you didn't really talk about all of Asia. So one of the things I wanted to correct was exactly that, because there really is only one correct definition of Asia. And it may surprise people to know that geographers have absolutely no dispute about this. Asia stretches all the way from the Mediterranean Sea, meaning Lebanon and Israel, and the Persian Gulf countries, in other words, the Red Sea, Saudi Arabia, and so forth, all the way over to Japan, and from Russia right down to here, the tippy tip of Southeast Asia and Singapore. And many would consider the Asian region to also include, of course, Australia and Oceania and the Pacific Islands. So there really is only one correct, you know, geographical, geological definition of Asia. And one of my main motivations was to portray this much larger Asia as inclusive of China. And there's a lot about China, obviously, in the book, but to really give the full picture of Asia and the story of these different civilizations coming together today as they are, especially in the last couple of decades. I would never claim that Asia is one unified thing. So that's, again, one of these sort of cardinal mistakes that a lot of people, you know, academics and others sort of make. They say, well, if you're writing about Asia, that must mean that you're treating Asia as if it's some kind of coherent, unified, integrated whole that speaks with one voice. Well, that's nonsense. In fact, this is the single most diverse region on the planet. And the purpose of writing about it as a whole is to actually celebrate that diversity rather than pretend that you could write just about China or just about Japan, and therefore you're speaking for all of Asia.
Right.
Instead, if you want to talk about Asia, you want to paint that diversity as much as humanly possible. And that was absolutely the hardest thing for me to do, because it would have been so easy to say, here's a book about Asia, let me write a profile about China, and then I'll write a chapter about India, and then I'll write a profile about Japan, and then I'm done. Instead, what you want to do is show how they influence each other, how the threads of culture, what I call commerce, conflict, and culture. These are the three C's of my book. Commerce, conflict, and culture. In every era, going back 4,000 years, you can see how these forces, how these threads have interplayed, interwoven, and shaped all Asian societies, how they have shaped each other. So in fact, we have 4,000 years of history of various Silk Road eras, of linguistic patterns being shared, of religious practices, of trade across this vast geography of Asia. And therefore, you truly cannot explain any Asian power or civilization today without reference to the others.
Okay. But as you described, right, you know, the countries that you mentioned, China, India, Japan, South Korea, for example, I mean, these are the Asian countries in the driving seat of the region. So how do you reconcile Asia as a whole being a global dominant force when in reality other countries may not be achieving the same kind of growth story that the countries you describe, that these countries are achieving?
It's another excellent question. And the way I do that is by talking about the waves of growth. So, you know, again, we tend to live in the moment and we think about the Asian stories being driven by China. But as I mentioned earlier, Japan was the first major Asian power to rise in the post-war decades after 1945. It became the world's second largest economy within just 25 years. Then came the tiger economies, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore. And then came China as the third wave. So we look at Asia today and we see China again as the driving force, but really China is just the third wave of Asian, modern Asian growth.
And there's a fourth wave. And a lot of this book is actually about the fourth wave, which is Pakistan through India. So in other words, South Asia through Southeast Asia, our countries, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, Thailand, mm-hmm. Philippines, and so forth. And if you look at these fourth wave of countries, South and Southeast Asia, their total population today is 2.5 billion people. They have, which is obviously a lot more than China. Every one of them has a younger population than China in terms of median age. Most of them are growing faster than China. But again, it's not either or, right? It's not about who's in the driver's seat. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that the first wave, Japan, influenced the second wave, right? South Korea was inspired by Japan, right? And how the first and second wave, Japan and the Tigers, inspired the third wave, which is China. Again, why is China China? Why did Deng Xiaoping exactly 40 years ago this year, right? Why did he decide to open up and modernize and reform China and allow in foreign investment and primarily take that investment from Taiwanese, from Hong Kong, from Singapore, from Japan? Because he was inspired by them. And they have to this day invested more in China than any other region in the world, right? So now who is driving this fourth wave of growth? The weaker countries that are not in the driver's seat, as you rightly pointed out. Who is making India, India? Who is making ASEAN the largest recipient of foreign investment in Asia as a region, right? And driving its growth rates forward. It's actually the first wave and the second wave and the third wave, right? It's Chinese investment in Malaysia. It's Korean investment in Vietnam. It's Japanese investment in Thailand. So again, you have to have a holistic and integrated picture to see how the next wave is unfolding. And that story includes China, but it's not all about China.
And it's interesting that you brought up populations, right? Because some of these countries are experiencing what has been described as the demographic trap. They have aging populations, declining populations. But India, in contrast, has 6.1% unemployment. That's at a four-year high. And 35% of their youths with graduate degrees are unemployed. So how would a country like India, and by extension also other countries in this fourth wave, overcome that demographic problem and avoid the pitfalls seen in the previous waves here in Asia?
That's actually a big theme in the book. And, you know, there is an assertion that Asia will undergo what's called a premature deindustrialization, meaning that, you know, industry is not creating as many jobs as it used to in the heyday when the tiger economies were growing, because so much is done more efficiently through technology and automation. So therefore, our slightly poor, you know, middle, lower middle income countries like India and in ASEAN will get caught in the middle income trap. So I address that head on with a lot of data in the book. What you'll see is that, in fact, our economies here are already largely driven by services, not by industry. So unlike the tiger economy era of the 70s and 80s, you know, we don't need all of those jobs making automobiles and appliances the way we used to. Now, bear in mind, ASEAN is getting all of those jobs. It's getting them from China because Chinese wages are rising and because of the trade war. Mm-hmm. And it's getting them because these economies in our region are getting more competitive. So ASEAN gets to have its cake and eat it too. It gets all the old school industrial jobs, but it's also already services economies driven by urbanization and digitization and financialization and everyone having apps and moving into cities and working in logistics and the peer-to-peer economy, right? So believe it or not, even though ASEAN countries are quite poor compared to Western countries, right? You know, per capita incomes maybe, you know, $5,000 to $10,000, not $50,000 to $60,000. But the economic structure of our economies is, believe it or not, quite similar to much more mature economies. So you ask about India, and India has a, you know, a problem at a larger scale than the countries in this region, because obviously it has a population of 1.4 billion people. And so therefore, you know, youth unemployment is a worrying thing. Where youth unemployment is much lower in Southeast Asia than it is in India, let's bear in mind. But for a country like India, they have to invest, you know, much more in infrastructure. They have to diversify the economy. They have to deregulate certain sectors and privatize. They have to enable more access to capital. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, you know, despite all the sort of turbulence in Indian politics, these things are gradually happening. Quite frankly, what I see is a lot of pragmatism around Asian governments. They're willing to do the necessary things that they weren't doing 20 years ago when the Asian financial crisis struck and really, you know, affected this region so violently.
But Parag, you also mentioned, when you mentioned ASEAN being able to have its cake and eat it too, in the sense that we are still getting manufacturing business from China as a result of the trade war, we can't necessarily rely on that either, right? Because the US-China trade war is this massive piece of geopolitical uncertainty. We don't know whether it'll end next week, next month, next year, or in 10 years. How do we move forward when we are when our manufacturing prowess is predicated on this extremely uncertain situation posed by President Donald Trump, but at the same time facing a declining manufacturing services sector in our own domestic markets?
Fortunately, it's not true that we depend on the outcome of the U.S.-China trade war, because if you look at the massive diversion of investment out of China into ASEAN, it began 10 years ago because Japan decided that it didn't want to have all of its eggs in the China basket, that it wanted to capitalize on the lower labor costs in Southeast Asia, that it wanted to access and sell more into Southeast Asian markets and, again, diversify export destinations. So all of this predates the trade war. Quite frankly, I've been writing about what you might today call the U.S.-China trade war over the course of 6 books in 15 years. So as far as I'm concerned, we've always been in what I call a tug of war. Everyone has always been competing to control supply chains. There's nothing new in that. Quite frankly, that's the history of the rise and fall of empires, is trying to control supply chains. And so I've dedicated my entire career to looking at it. There's nothing new whatsoever in what's happening right now. And there's always multiple players, not just two. The trade war only accelerates what's already been happening, and it strengthens the industrial base of Southeast Asia. It helps our countries here modernize faster. And at the same time, it's not that markets are closing, because if you do have the regional comprehensive economic partnership, as you mentioned earlier, kicking in, that's going to help Asian economies, if you will, sort of cushion each other by expanding trade with each other as exports to the United States may decline. But again, even that is sort of a short-term blip, because let's remember that China's trade surplus with the United States still continues to expand. Its exports to the United States are still growing despite the tariffs. So we should be very, very careful not to confuse kind of blips and trends, cyclical things versus structural things. And the rise of Asia in terms of growth and income and liberalization of economies and billions of people entering the consumer marketplace and the rise of investment and trade, all of those things always correlate historically to more trade with neighbors. And we're seeing that happening across, just across ASEAN, but we're also seeing it across all of Asia. And that's the kind of data and the visualization that I provide in the book that explains how, given how strong the trend has been in the last 30 years, it's certainly not reversing itself. If anything, it's accelerating.
I'm speaking to Dr. Parag Khanna, author of the book The Future is Asian. After this, a look at China and how Malaysia can escape the middle income trap. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Dr. Parag Khanna, author of the book The Future is Asian. Parag, earlier we were talking about Asia as a diverse entity, but now let's focus in a little bit on the elephant in the room, China. Because as you've said, China's a big part of any discussion about Asia. And you have said that China's gradual economic deceleration is not a cooling of the Asian story. And we have seen China's deceleration made concrete in its Q2 GDP numbers that were below expectations. So what do you see as the future here for China? How long do you think it will be able to maintain essentially the superpower status it currently enjoys in the region opposite the US?
It's a great question. One of the key things about understanding Asian history economically and geopolitically is that Asia has always been multipolar. So again, China has never dominated the full breadth of Asia properly defined. Mm-hmm. So the notion that China is suddenly already today and destined to be tomorrow the dominant power across all of Asia is an absolute historical farce. I know that it's difficult to swallow that, since every book we've read and every person we hear on TV for the last 15 years has been saying exactly right. They've been saying exactly that. But history tells a completely different story about which, there's really no debate. The Mongols were able to conquer most of Asia, and that was 750 years ago. So if that's the history that one sees repeating itself, you're welcome to that point of view. But the fact is that Asia has been multipolar, Japan, China, India, Australia, Russia, you can think of Korea, and even to some degree ASEAN as it integrates, mm-hmm. as being various poles of power in Asia. So the Chinese economy is slowing down, but the other poles are still there. And as I said before, you know, the like ASEAN and India are growing faster than China, and that's going to accelerate this return to a multipolar economic and geopolitical story in Asia. And so it's important for us, those of us in Asia, whatever country we come from, to remind everyone that even if China is slowing, it doesn't mean that everyone else isn't growing at the same time. And also, let's bear in mind that when you're an economy as large as China's, and you and your growth slows from 8% to 6% or 6% to 4%, you're still contributing about $250+ billion a year of economic growth to the world. So it's not exactly trivial.
But even if China is not the superpower that it is made out to be, right? China is one of the biggest investors in many of the Asian countries in the region. Like, it is one of Malaysia's major trading partners, for example, and we're not the only one. I think it is ASEAN's primary trade partner. So if China does decelerate, it would also be detrimental for other countries in the region, wouldn't it?
So to the extent that countries are, you know, very dependent on China as a trade, as a sort of outward trade partner, you know, and if that trade dependency is greater than 50%, then obviously a China slowdown is substantial. But I think that we actually can't be so mechanical about these things. To be honest, economics is as you know, very complicated. So when people look at the China slowdown and they see their own slowdown, you know, and they say, okay, well, you know, A has led to B, you know, and they see causation there. You have to be very careful about that, because even though China's economy is slowing, it actually has been increasing its imports of commodities and other goods recently, which has really surprised economists. So if you really break it down, what the story in China has to be seen in multiple levels. It could be that China's imports are expanding, but just not for you. It could be that your problem is not China slowing down, but China innovating and its own companies displacing your exports in its market, right? So, for example, for Malaysia and Singapore and other countries that have been exporting electronics to China, China could be growing fast or growing slow. Either way, its imports of your electronics are going to go down because they make their own electronics now, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to be thinking about transformation and innovation, not just simply correlating growth high, growth low, exports high, exports low. And this is, you know, this is that, quite frankly, is just the simplest level of breaking it down further. We can go into a lot more detail. So yes, China is slowing, but China's investment and its growing outward investment is helping a lot of poorer countries modernize. So China may be slowing down in terms of trade, but trade isn't even the most important part of the world economy, not by a long shot. You know, investment is, capital markets and capital flows are way more important. You know, as an aside, I think you would agree with this. You know, we talk so much about trade, mostly because it's the easiest thing for people to understand. But if you look at capital flows, China is massively importing capital because it's going to current account deficit. This is why they're opening their capital markets and liberalizing them exactly this year. They may be losing a few billion dollars here and there in exports, but they're looking at the trillions, not the billions, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, trade is billions and capital, you know, and in finance is trillions. So if we look at it from that lens, we again see huge amounts of capital flows in Asia, across Asian borders, and Asia attracting those capital flows as they also liberalize their capital accounts and debt and equity markets the way China is doing. And the way, remember, the way Japan and Korea have already done for decades, because China is not doing anything a whole lot different than what Japan and Korea did before it, right? It's just doing it with this iron authoritarian discipline. But it's doing very, very similar things. And other poorer countries are going to start to do those things as well.
Right. So one of the things that you took on in your book was that you spotlighted a few of these initiatives, like the Belt and Road Initiative, like RCEP, because these are partnerships and organizations put forward by Asian countries, run by Asian countries within that Asian framework. So how likely is it, do you think, that we will be seeing maybe a new block of countries forming here within Asia, positioning itself almost in opposition to the US, particularly as if we see a Trump presidency last past 2020?
Well, you know, I describe Asia as a sponge, not a block, right? It's a region that has absorbed so many lessons and practices from each other and from the rest of the world, including from the United States, and it still continues to. Let's not forget that the United States is the largest investor in ASEAN. It's one of the largest investors in India, right? One of the largest investors in Japan. So it's not just about trade. It's not just about investment. It's not just about military. It's not just about culture. It's all of these things and technology too. So I don't see this Asian sponge becoming a block. I don't see it becoming a block that stands behind China. I don't see it becoming a block that is against China or a united block against America or a triangle. A lot of people like to make these neat, simple, geometric kinds of configurations and assertions. That's just not the way Asia has worked historically. And I spend a lot of time in the book kind of debunking the mythologies that arise from European history, where most of our theoretical models come from. We look at European history in World War I, and we see these alliance patterns that are very rigid and lead to these escalations and conflict. But you can't find me a single example from 4,000 years of Asian history where a scenario like World War I has played out. So I find it, again, rather comical that we, you know, and I'm saying this as an American, which is what's so funny about it, you know. I mean, I was entirely raised in that academic tradition, and I'm just disappointed, quite frankly, in ourselves and my fellow Asians, if you might say, that we haven't been able to say that Western international relations theory doesn't really map neatly onto Asia, and Asia is the majority of the world population and countries, so how about we actually explain our own behavior in our own terms? And in Asian history, past and even present and likely in the future, you don't find these automatic alliances. You don't find that, you know, the what one country says, my enemies attack my friend, therefore I have to attack my enemy. You don't have behavior like that in Asia. So, you know, I'm urging a lot more subtlety in appreciating how countries deal with each other, how they deal with China, how they deal with America. If I had to sum it up in one word, it would be frenemies. You know, everyone wants to be friends and enemies and rivals, competitors, collaborators at the same time. More formally, I wrote my first book about this. I call it multi-alignment, which is a fancy way of saying we don't want to ally with one country or another country. We want to ally in all directions and multiple directions. So I call that multi-alignment. That, in one word, best describes how you see most Asian countries behaving. And quite frankly, that's how smart countries behave.
So Parag, let's also just bring it very quickly back home here for our listeners in Malaysia. Malaysia has been stuck in a middle income trap for more than a decade, while other Asian countries like Vietnam are powering ahead. So what is your long-term view on Malaysia? Is Japan our future? How do we ride on this rise of the Asian region?
Well, the definition of middle income encompasses such a broad spectrum of incomes that you're destined to be stuck in it for quite a while, as are most countries who are in that so-called trap. So a country like Malaysia, you know, has been talked about for a long time as, you know, on its way to being a first world country. That's something to be proud of in terms of what Malaysia has already done in terms of infrastructure investment, modernization, economic diversification, using the natural resource endowments well, managing a diverse population. Obviously, there are mistakes that have been made along the way. Obviously, there's inefficiency, there's been corruption. And the most important thing to remember about whether it's Malaysia or whether it's ASEAN as a whole, this is not the era of the Vietnam War. You know, this region, our region, is not being invaded. All of our mistakes are self-inflicted wounds. We can fix them. The things that Malaysia needs to do, whether it's economic reform, whether it's more pro-poor investment, whether it's anti-corruption measures, whether it's more better investment in education, no one is stopping us from doing the right thing. I think that the people of Malaysia are educated. I think, you know, there are enough people in the government. I've met so many of them who are competent, who do have, you know, the right ideas in mind. So whether or not you get out of the so-called middle income trap in terms of precisely measuring your per capita income in U.S. dollars, that's really not relevant in this world. We have to focus on doing the right things, empowering people, and then the income and the quality of life improvements, and that's ultimately what this is about, are going to flow from themselves. Let's be ambitious about how, you know, the statistics, the models, the pathways that have defined economic growth and social and human development in past generations don't exactly apply in the 21st century. Things are different now, and it's really, again, like I said, it's up to Asians to decide for themselves if they're going to follow the formula and do it right.
Thank you very much for speaking to us this morning, Parag.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. Parag Khanna, a managing partner of FutureMap, which is a data and scenario-based strategic advisory firm, former senior fellow at the Lee Kuan Yew School, and author of the book, The Future is Asian. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, Frost & Sullivan's Malaysia Mobile Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.